Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Show. On the show this week, Marks and Spencers is our result of the week. Madeline Taylor's here to talk through them. Our personal finance expert, Leonora Walters, joins the show for the first time. She's talking SIPs. And not 30 minutes before we've come on air, Rishi Sunak has announced the details of his windfall tax on energy companies. We'll be picking through that. Let's get on with the show. Companies and Markets Show. It is Thursday, the 26th of May, just past 1 p.m. as we speak. Good to have you back, listener. Good to be back. Joined in the studio by Alex Newman. Hi, Alex.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm well. Madeline Taylor, you're back. Hello.
Hello.
Mark Robinson. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, John.
And first time for Leonora Walters. Hi, Leonora.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Good to have you along. And Dan Jones, as always. Dan, what are we talking about today?
We've got a few things coming up. We've got Marks and Spencer's results as our result of the week, as you mentioned. We're going to be talking about SIPs and retirement saving and asset allocation. And hot off the press, we're going to be talking about the windfall tax that has literally just been announced, or the temporary targeted profits levy, if you want to use the official term.
Yes, exactly. And that's where I was going to start my mini news roundup as well. Yeah, the government have finally come around to a windfall tax on energy companies, or, yeah, as Dan just said, a temporary targeted energy profits levy. The headline rate of tax on profits is 25%, I believe, and it comes as the cost of living crisis rumbles on, and also as Partygate scandal intensifies. Coincidence? Maybe. U-turn? Definitely. Anyway, political cynicism aside, Dan and this lot will be going into the details and implications a little later in the show. Elsewhere, on Tuesday, mining giant Glencore agreed to pay $1.2 billion in fines across the US and UK. It comes after a three-year investigation by the UK's Serious Fraud Office resulted in the company admitting bribery offences within its oil division. Alex Hamer has the full write-up on the IC website. Wednesday evening, we had news that the boss of JD Sports, Peter Cowgill, has stepped down with immediate effect. It is understood Cowgill quit after he tried to block attempts by the board to split the roles of chair and chief executive, which Cowgill has jointly held since 2014. JD Sports shares tumbled 12% at the news. Another boss on the move, Avon Protection's chief exec, Paul McDonald, is stepping down after the company issued another disappointing set of results. McDonald has been CEO for 5 years and will leave the post in September. Shares sank 17% on Tuesday. Ted Baker has moved a step closer to sale. The fashion retailer said it selected a, quote, preferred counterparty. There has been a flurry of private equity interest in the company, though Sycamore Partners, who made two official bids in March, are now confirmed as out of the running. Company's results in the magazine and on our website this week from Premier Foods, 91, Royal Mail, EasyJet, Shaftesbury, Hollywood Bowl, SSE, and quite a few more. Go and check that out. Quick look at the markets now. Will the S&P 500 break its streak of 8 consecutive weeks of losses? At the time of recording, it's up 2%. In fact, we're seeing marginal gains across Wall Street. FTSE 100 also up a couple of percent so far this week.
Thank you, John. Yeah, so we are going to start the rest of the show with a look at the high street. We're going to talk about M&S, which put out pretty good interims 6 months ago and has now come out with some fairly decent full-year results. But obviously, the context is very different now. As with many of its peers, the focus is very much on inflation and margins and outlook for the months ahead. Maddie is with us. Maddie wrote her analysis of the results this week. Let's sort of start, I guess, just by taking a step back and looking at the numbers. We've still got them on hold. What's your kind of take on the full-year figures?
Well, I think one of the really important things about this set of results is that it was the chief executive, Steve Rose, last. He's now leaving after about 40 years at the business. And it's also been 4 years since he delivered this turnaround plan that was rather dramatically entitled Facing the Facts. And it was a more honest look at M&S's journey. And at the time, it was struggling really quite a lot against a declining kind of home and clothing section. And there were a lot of things it decided to do at that point. And now this has been billed as kind of the final judgment on that plan since it's Steve Rowe's last. And yeah, it's going to be a long time before we're really going to be able to judge the results of that entire plan. It was a sweeping kind of vision of closing lots of stores, you know, changing the entire focus between the food section and the home and clothing section. But one thing that we really can say so far is that the home and clothing section's decline has been stemmed, which is a real achievement given the current environment with consumer spending and inflation all coming and hitting all retailers. You know, we've had Debenhams, Topshop, lots of high-profile closures in the last few years. So it is impressive that they're now 3.8% up in terms of sales on their pre-COVID levels. That's mostly been achieved by slashing their levels of discounting, but also kind of updating their range of brands that they're offering. So, you know, props to them on that. However, there are the significant downsides as well, as we've alluded to, with consumer spending and inflation hitting their costs. So they have said that they're expecting profits to fall in the next year from about $523 million this year to about $440 next. So obviously, this turnaround has kind of reached a stalling point, if you will, for now.
Yeah, it is interesting on the clothing side, as you say, that's an area that's, you know, struggled for a long time. You do kind of wonder if they still know who they're targeting. I mean, you know, getting rid of the discounters, the discounts, you know, maybe looking back towards that kind of classical M&S customer base. They've benefited from some of those people who've fallen by the wayside, like Debenhams. I mean, do we get the sense at the end of this turnaround program that they know who they're targeting now? Do they have a niche? Or are they still trying to perhaps be all things to all people, maybe?
Well, I think it's difficult for them because they have got this image as such a sturdy, steady, kind of all-rounder brand. And so it's difficult, I think, for them to find that niche, as you say, because they're just this, yes, this all-rounder. However, what they've done, which seems to have worked so far, is they've got in a number of brands like Jaeger, which they saved from collapse last year. And they've also had high-profile partnerships with companies like Ghost, which both of those are sort of at the higher end of the range, appealing to a more affluent, possibly older consumer. And that does seem to be working. However, they also seem... They have also been emphasizing value in some areas, including of some slightly outdated fashions, like they mentioned cutting prices on jeggings in their recent. And it seems like they are still a little bit finding their way in that area.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking about this question earlier, you know, who is their customer? And then about 10 minutes ago, I'm on holiday next week, and my wife is in M&S. She sent me a photo of some T-shirts, said, should I get you some T-shirts? So apparently their customer is me, you know, maybe a slightly behind the times, late 30s male. Mark Robinson, what's your kind of take on the M&S, the results and the turnaround?
Well, Dan, I was just engaged in a bit of reminiscence there as well, because I remember the first time I went into an M&S store would have been in the late 1960s, I guess. And you look back to that period then, and there was really limited competition in terms of national chains. You think of something like Army and Navy stores and so forth. But they were in a sort of prime position there. And I think the brand then, the emphasis was on quality, but at a value price. And I think they tried to take that forward. And that model worked right through the 1960s, of course, the 70s, and some way into the 1980s. But then you had a range of high street competitors come onto the market. And latterly, you've got the influence of online shopping, of course, but also the rise of fast fashion. So it's an increasingly crowded space for them there as well. And I think Stuart Rose, when he was there, struggled with this problem for years, even though, you know, by contrast, the food side of the business, you know, went ahead at a great rate of knots. It was very successful. But every chief executive since the mid-1980s has struggled with the clothing brand. Up until this present set of figures, it may well be that this is slightly misleading in a sense. They're going to have to, and there's signs they're doing this, but they're going to have to concentrate all the more on inventory levels. And Maddie pointed out the fact that they've reduced the rates of discounting, which is critical for the business. And presumably, on that basis, they're going to increase their stock turn. So it'll be a more efficient operation going forward, I'd imagine. However, we do have this situation at the moment where wholesale prices are outstripping retail, and that gap is actually widening. So I made a point in one of the articles last week that you know, you reach a certain point where you can only pass on so much of these cost increases through to your customer base. And we may well be there already, in which case that's just going to go and eat into earnings. So, you know, it's definitely a creditable result on their part. But I guess looking ahead, it's those sort of meat and potato metrics that are the ones we'll have to look at relating to inventory and discounting.
I suppose the question for all the listeners really is, you know, what does this, how does this affect the share price going forward? As I said at the start, at the top, we've still got them on hold. You know, there's a lot of investment spend to come. The dividend hasn't come back, which, you know, I think a lot of people obviously used the last couple of years. Well, they had to get rid of dividends, but maybe they're not coming back as quickly in some cases as one may have expected. There's still, you know, some way to go despite the big share price fall this year in terms of value there. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways it's hard to argue with the dividend still being missing because, as we've said, they are facing quite a difficult next couple of years. Plus, they've got this exit from Russia. They've planned to completely shut that down, which they've taken a £31 million charge on. And yeah, what we've seen before, encouragingly, is that companies that continue to actually invest in their organic growth, even during tougher periods, they tend to come out of that stronger. You know, obviously there are limits to that, but in effect, you could see them cutting that dividend and choosing to focus on growth as potentially a positive in the long term. Not for now, though.
Yeah, I suppose on that note, maybe the flip side, we've got to finish the M&S discussion with a look at Ocado, that side. I mean, the joint venture there is put in some decent figures, it seems, in recent months in the interims and certainly the last full years, you'd expect. But they're saying, you know, that profit's pretty much evaporated for this year. To me, it kind of raises the perennial question again of how much money you can ever expect to make from online shopping or online grocery shopping. You know, we've had a recommendation from Leonora for their apple and cinnamon bake, I think it was. But quality of products aside, it's still difficult to make money out of that part of the business.
Yep, the margins are even lower than they are for traditional grocery because of all of the delivery costs as well. But then you've also got to consider that both M&S and Ocado, they're both considered premium in terms of their food offering, which might not stand them in such good stead in the coming months with more people having to economise. You know, we've already seen Lidl and Aldi have been the only real grocery winners this year, the only ones to really keep growing sales convincingly. And so it is difficult to see what the future is for that. It's already been weighed down in the past few years anyway, when it sort of the Ocado retail segment has been weighed down because they couldn't actually even expand capacity fast enough to really benefit from the COVID, obviously the boost that they would have got during COVID. So I think it's obviously something to keep watching.
Another work in progress, I think. Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Let's look at a slightly longer term time horizon. And our cover story this week, which is a SIP special, looking at all things personal pension. We've got a range of features. We're looking at asset allocation. We're looking at charges and, you know, how to compare and contrast. We're looking at the difference between a platform SIP and a full service SIP, which is something I think people don't often consider. They might not need to, but we'll come to that in a minute. Leonora, you have written and overseen a lot of these features this week. Let's kick off by, I think maybe, you know, this is obviously a bit of a fraught time for markets, but we contrast that with, you know, the long-term time horizons that people should have, particularly when saving for retirement. What kind of changes, what kind of interest have we seen in recent months in terms of how people are using their SIP, what kind of things they're investing in, that kind of thing?
Well,
I think the good news is investment platforms such as Hargreaves Lansdown report that there's largely not been much change in how their customers are allocating their SIPs. And that's generally good because you shouldn't make knee-jerk reactions to events or market falls and sell and lock in losses. It's particularly the right course of action for SIP investors in the accumulation phase who've got 10 years or more until they cash in or start drawing from pensions, because they've got long-term investment horizons, so should be able to ride the recent volatility. And for them, not staying invested could hinder the growth of their SIPs. There's always a but. Another popular platform, Interactive Investor, has actually reported that wealth preservation investment trusts are more popular over the first 4 months of this year compared to last year. Now, if you're in the accumulation phase of your pensions and you've got 10 or more years to run, you shouldn't really be holding, you know, wealth preservation funds. You should be aiming for maximum growth in your pension. If you're planning to cash in some or all of your pension to buy an annuity in the 10 years leading up to doing this, it makes sense to perhaps gradually move your pension into low-risk assets, basically to lock in your decade of gains. You know, this is regardless of market conditions. It's not because of what's happening now. Even if markets are wonderful, you know, if you're going to buy an annuity in 10 years or less, you start to need to, you know, dial down the risk. That said, it's a gradual process. You know, and if you've got 10 years or 8 years, even 7 years, you know, making those sales when markets are down is probably not the right moment to do it. There's obviously a lot of SIP investors aren't going to do that. They're probably planning to go into drawdown of their pensions. And if you plan to go into drawdown, you know, yeah, you shouldn't really be in wealth preservation funds. You need high-risk growth assets to ensure your pension pot will last until the end of your life. So you shouldn't be too cautious. You perhaps maybe want to be a bit more balanced, perhaps more of an income profile. But no, you shouldn't be, you know, offloading, you know, growth assets and piling into funds, you know, perhaps just whatever, stay neutral. Yeah. If you're retired and in drawdown, obviously it's a concern, but a good tactic here is rather than, you know, piling into, you know, low risk, low return funds and de-risking your pension, you know, have your pension in growth investments, perhaps income investments, but also have a good cash reserve. So when markets are choppy like they are now, stop drawing from your pension and use your cash. And advisors suggest that when you're in retirement and perhaps in drawdown, have 1 to 3 years of your expenditure in cash.
Yeah, I think that's sensible. And as you say, the wealth preservation funds that proved quite popular, it did raise an eyebrow. You know, the likes of, we're thinking here of, you know, investment trusts, I suppose, like Capital Gearing, RIT Capital, things like that. Obviously very good in down markets, but as you say, when your time horizons are so lengthy, might be worth reflecting on that, I think. One final point that we're going to touch on now is the full service SIP. Now, you know, obviously, there's been a real boom in personal pension saving the past 5, 6, 7 years, really, since the pension freedoms. Platform SIPs, you know, the standard pension pot has been the real beneficiary of that. But there are also more complicated SIPs available for people who want to hold commercial property, maybe some unconventional assets. And we discussed that a little bit in the issue. There are obviously pitfalls to watch for here, and you've got to be very careful. But maybe if you could just talk a little bit about those full service SIPs, as we call them.
Yeah, right. Basically, what people mean by a full service SIP is, you know, something that allows you to invest in more than the basic platform SIP. So it allows you to invest in all the things they do. So like open ended funds, investment plus ETFs and direct shareholdings. But with a full service SIP, depending on the provider, you may also be able to hold commercial property and esoteric assets such as gold bullion, unlisted shares in companies, derivatives and direct bond holdings. The downside to this, though, is that full service SIPs have more expensive annual charges. And this is particularly the case if you hold commercial property, because there are extra charges on top of that, particularly relating to the property. So, for example, from June this year, the Barnett Waddingham Flexible SIP will charge a property purchase fee of at least £800 and annual fee per property of £200. And one of the financial advisors I spoke to said, look, if you hold commercial property in a SIP, for various property and administration charges could add up to £3,000 or more per year. So it's not cheap. I think the bottom line here is, if you don't want to hold these unusual assets in your SIP, don't have a full service SIP. Keep costs low and go for one of the efficient low-cost platform SIPs, you know, because they're great for investing in funds and shares and sort of more mainstream securities.
Yeah, I think that's right. For the vast majority of people, that will be the sensible choice. We've got lots more on SIPs in this week's issue, so do look out for that. But now let's turn to the issue of the day, really, the energy profits levy. I was writing the editorial this week, earlier this week, and I said when we wrote our cover feature on this last month, we speculated that Sunak might be pushed into a U-turn, pushed into action by October. And as I said in that column, it looks like it'll now be a matter of weeks, if not days. And in the event, it was hours, because there has been an announcement this afternoon by the Chancellor. Alex, we haven't spoken to you yet on this podcast. Apologies for keeping you in the dark. But
No. Been fascinating discussions.
But let's kick things off maybe with your take. I mean, obviously, it has just been announced. The electricity generators, which were speculated about earlier this week, the power generators, likes of Drax, SSE, have avoided this charge for now. But what's your kind of snap reaction to the announcement?
A place to start with maybe is actually back with that feature that we did, that Gemma Slingo did a month or so ago, which is looking very, very prescient now. And unfortunately, she had to make many of these hedges, which you alluded to, that you made in your editorial this week. She did conclude by saying that for now, the North Sea windfall tax looks unlikely, given that it looks partly because it looks at odds with the government's political philosophy. I think what this week has shown is that there is no value in ideological purity. You know, so it's another reminder that governments and politicians inevitably will respond to the situation on the ground, and that any kind of conversation we've seen in the last few weeks about it being ideologically inconsistent with a conservative government that wants to encourage competition and investment and level playing field for markets, the times of crisis, which I think it's fair to say we are in now from a cost of living perspective, those considerations go out the window. So yeah, we can sort of talk a little bit about the details in a minute. But yeah, I mean, to turn to your other point on the electricity generators, some of which have done very, very well. And just looking through some of the briefing notes they've given on the profits levy, they seem to have left the door open potentially for some action there on these windfall profits that are also being made elsewhere in the UK energy sector. But for now, it's concentrated, it looks like, solely on the oil and gas producers. So it's interesting how they've become it's upstream, which is the root of all evils at the moment, rather than the broader infrastructure, which is also benefiting from higher prices at the moment.
Yeah, I think it seems quite likely if things do stay as they are in terms of pricing, then we will see some more action later this year. It seems almost a question of logistics right now is the reason the electricity generators haven't been included, because they're still trying to work out what might happen there, at least with oil and gas. They seem to have lent quite heavily, again, as I wrote this week, on the supplementary charge, which was introduced and increased, again, under the Conservative government in 2011. Likewise, with that charge, what's happened again here is that there are allowances being made for new investment, which is clearly an attempt to head off some of the common criticisms of such taxes, that they will stymie new investment, particularly at a time when, you know, our own energy supply is looking so uncertain, part of the reason we're in this problem in the first place.
Yeah, it's like 80% or something, 80 or 90% relief. I mean, is that a SOP? I don't know. It's quite hard to say, isn't it? Because at the same time, the government is effectively on the other side, it's committing to net zero targets by 2050. So encouraging long-term investment in the North Sea, which has kind of been discouraged for the past decade anyway, given the combination of levies and you just look at what the oil majors have done. You know, they don't really see a future in the North Sea. BP's reducing their output. We've got this group Harbour, which has swept up a number of the maturing fields. It's kind of like a cigar butt investing approach to the North Sea that the players that are left there appear to be taking. So we might look at, back on this and think this is actually quite a clever levy, that you're not really hitting an industry which is expected to actually grow in the next 20 years.
Mark, what's your take on the levy and the implications for shareholders as well in these companies?
It's worth mentioning as well that there are already tax incentives in place for upstream producers, but I have a different take on it. I think I've got a more mainstream take in that I think there's a problem with the government messaging in this one as well, because what you need if you're an oil company or any company where you've got large front-loaded costs, you need some surety on tax levels going forward. And so I think it's going to act as a major disincentive for producers as well, particularly in the North Sea, where you've got much higher break-even levels as well. I mean, if you could draw an analogy, see the excess profits. Well, there's no such thing as excess profits, but the profits that have been made by pharmaceutical companies over the last few years. Do they warrant a super tax, a levy on them, just because of circumstances dictate that they've become highly profitable within a brief period of time? It's very difficult to reconcile the government's stance on wanting to reduce our dependence on overseas oil and gas with this tax as well. Because I mean, I'd like to look at the numbers eventually, but I just don't know the amount of money that will be raised, how it'll benefit UK households. But it's more of the messaging thing for me, and it could even be filed under the general heading of short-termism in government again. It's a sort of quick political fix. It'll play well with households, but as I say, companies like oil companies, where they're sort of investing huge amounts of capital up front, they want some sort of certainty on future tax levels. I mean, it's interesting as well that this happened under Conservative government, but you know, you can go back to the Thatcher years as well, and Geoffrey Howe introduced a similar levy on the banks at the time as well. It's anathema to me as well. Imagine what happens, this eventually falls on the utilities too. So you're going to have government intervention on an industry or a sector which is also governed by government intervention. Where does this all stop?
I think there's definitely a number of points there that are crucial. I think the government has said they expect it to raise $5 billion over the next year, which will go towards some of the new measures announced today on energy bills, which you can see when you're someone, I suppose, like the current Chancellor, who's so opposed to extra borrowing, given the spending we've had of recent years. You know, he's changed his mind very quickly, which it has been an issue. It was only a few weeks ago when he was saying to these companies, you know, if you do invest more, you know, you can avoid this kind of windfall tax. And now here we are saying, well, we won't need to invest more, but we're going to tax you anyway. The other, I suppose, point of view from the shareholder perspective is how long this tax lasts and how long this uncertainty will hang over the businesses. Just looking at some of the details today, there is a sunset clause, but it's not until the end of 2025. So this could be here for some time. The government have also said it will end the levy or phase out the levy if oil and gas prices return to historically more normal levels, which, you know, gives them, seems to me, a lot of wiggle room for defining what normal levels are. Again, 10 years ago when this was introduced, there was a set level of $75 a barrel of Brent. This time it seems a bit more up in the air. So yeah, it does seem like that uncertainty for shareholders, for companies, is going to persist for a while longer. If we return maybe to the electricity generators, the power generators, you know, that is this going to be an overhang for them now for months, perhaps, until we can see some clarity on whether they're going to be charged, what they're going to be charged?
Yeah, almost definitely. I mean, they're not, a number of the utility providers as well that Mark mentioned, I mean, they're not trading on phenomenally high multiples. But I mean, we saw this week there was big sell-offs in SSC and Centrica on the possibility that they were going to be included in this levy framework that's been announced today. More broadly, I not to backtrack in any way, I do sort of, I kind of also agree with what Mark's saying. And the not that this is set to send a chill over what investment committees looking at, you know, long-term capital projects in the UK are going to decide. But, I mean, this isn't actually the first instance we've seen in the last year even of a subsector within an industry that has seen outsized profits kind of being put on the hook to provide a sort of sticking plaster for, you know, an issue which has caused a big headache amongst within the government, and that is the house builders. So, you know, they, although the issues with fire safety is partly, they are partly to blame for that, it's not, they're not the only responsible party in this. Yet it seems that, you know, the most expedient thing for Michael Gove to do, and they decided this, was to sort of put the levies and windfall taxes essentially on their doorstep. So, yeah, there is a question hanging over the electricity providers, but you could make the case for other critical infrastructure providers in the country as well. The precedent has kind of been set now, so the next crisis might fall on your shoulders, corporate PLC.
Just to bring things full circle, I think it was only a few days ago, M&S were describing the prospects for an online sales tax as morally bankrupt as well, I think was the phrase used. So yeah, there's a number of sectors facing...
If they're not making profits out of their online operation, then they're fine, you know.
I think, the online grocery is perhaps...
I mean, that's seen as well as a sort of a remedial action for the UK high street to talk of where, you know, well, that's the headline any rate, but I guess like any other government exercises, it's a question of sort of boosting finances. It'll be interesting if you spoke to some fund managers of income funds, what they'd say about this as well, the fact that the oil companies have been such high payers through the years, and so have the utilities for that matter as well. So, I mean, that's another knock-on effect that is detrimental over the long term, I think.
It's fair to say, isn't it, the super majors are so geographically diversified now that the relative hit to them won't be as pronounced as it's going to be for the UK-only producers.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, we shall see. Yeah, we shall keep tabs on how this all evolves and how, indeed, you know, these levies continue to evolve, because at the moment it certainly seems like a case of more, not less. That brings us to the end of the show, unfortunately. We've had a great discussion today, and thank you to all of our speakers. Thank you to Alex, to Mark, to Maddie, to Leonora, and to John. There will be no Companies and Markets show next week due to the Jubilee Bank holiday and all the celebrations therein, but we will see you the week after that. Goodbye.
The Companies and Markets show was hosted by Dan Jones and edited and produced by me, John Rogers. Don't forget to head on over to the iTunes store, give us a rating and a review if you like what you're listening to. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.